Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Today, I want to talk about freedom around the world. George Bush often talks about promoting freedom around the world, but we have a mishmash of U.S. foreign policy, which means that we support some dictatorships while attacking others. So today I want to talk about United States policy in Cuba with the ending of Fidel Castro's regime, in Pakistan, where we have a strong and important Pakistani vote against American ally Musharraf. In Kosovo, we have a declaration of independence drawing on the war that we did under Bill Clinton in the 1990s, Africa, where George Bush is visiting this week, and Gaza, where Hamas is putting the people of Gaza in their worst misery ever, devoting the Strip's entire meager resources into a useless, murderous war, trying to kill as many Israeli civilians as possible. There's a lot to talk about with foreign policy. Before we go there, I want to briefly congratulate Senator Barack Obama on his very convincing win in Wisconsin last night. He not only overwhelmingly won the black vote, he overwhelmingly won the white men's vote. And in fact, just barely lost to Hillary Clinton among white women. He is doing better among people in the lower socioeconomic class. Barack Obama is showing convincingly that he can win all segments of our party. It's not over. Texas and Ohio, I think, will be the really important vote. If Hillary Clinton loses both Texas and Ohio on March 4th, I think she's going to have a compelling reason not to continue. So I want to congratulate Senator Obama on that. Also, I do want to very briefly talk a little bit more about telecom immunity. We'll do more of that tomorrow. But simply to note what I saw in today's Washington Post. where the United States Supreme Court dismissed the lawsuit of the American Civil Liberties Union against warrantless wiretapping. They didn't say whether the people who sued the government were being tapped or weren't being tapped. They simply said that the people suing couldn't prove they were being tapped and therefore had no lawsuit. Now, I want you to think about this weird logic and how this works here. You have people who we know are being wiretapped without a warrant, and if we are to believe Mark Klein and Quest and AT&T and many of the others who've talked about this, there are millions of Americans, indeed probably hundreds of millions of us being tapped, but we can't know who. We can't know if we're being tapped at all, so how can we sue? And as you know, George Bush refuses to comply with congressional subpoenas, asking him who's being tapped. And as you also know from the detailed show I did yesterday, the Senate, at least, would pass the bill that not only gives George Bush retroactive amnesty for all his illegal actions in tapping American citizens, but would prevent us from ever finding out who the president tapped. And those that are being tapped, well, some of them are funneled away into secret prisons and tortured. The Attorney General of the United States, Michael Mukasey, says that he believes that Americans, including American citizens, taken on American soil, can be thrown in jail for life without charges. Now, if you say that the nation's chief law enforcement officer maybe should read the Constitution, you know, I agree with you. But he hasn't, and that's what he said. So maybe some of this secret information is being used to throw people in jail. We'll never know. Due to nice circular reasoning, we can't sue because we can't know what the government is doing. And we can't sue to find out what the government is doing because of the State Secrets Act. Indeed, about the only way out of this morass, the only way, is to have the House bill prevail so that there is no retroactive amnesty, and to hold in contempt George Bush's officials who refuse to obey subpoenas. As I said, the House took that step, that very first step, toward preserving our Constitution last week. And for all the criticism that Nancy Pelosi often gets from me and others, we all should praise what she did last week and encourage our member of Congress not to cave in next week when Congress comes back in town. Now to the main subject at hand, freedom around the world, and I want to specifically invite all of you to join in this discussion. Whether you want to talk about Cuba or Pakistan or Kosovo or Africa or Gaza or any other corner of the world that I have neglected to mention, please give me a call. We have lots of time. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. Let's start with Cuba. In Cuba, we have Fidel Castro ending his reign. Now, this is very interesting. Fidel Castro, of course, ruled Cuba for some 50 years, and he is finally sick enough to leave office. But what does this mean for U.S. policy? It means that after nine presidents trying to stop Fidel Castro, he goes the way of all dictators, right? He goes away on his own. Now, this is very interesting because the argument was made that we need to embargo Cuba, we need sanctions on Cuba in order to stop the Castro government. And I, for one, often like sanctions. I support sanctions. But for sanctions to work, you need worldwide support. And the world never saw Castro as the threat that we saw. Now, let me be clear. I am not a supporter of Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro is a dictator, like so many dictators around the world, like Saddam Hussein, or for that matter, Musharraf of Pakistan, or for that matter, the kings of Saudi Arabia, or for that matter, any of the various dictatorships in Africa that George Bush is sucking up to. When you have a dictatorship, and of course there's more benevolent and less benevolent dictators, but when you have a dictatorship, you have control of the press, control of the media, you make sure that there are no views expressed publicly that oppose the government. One of the problems I have in America is the extent the media is rapidly being bought up and controlled by a few corporations. Luckily, we still can talk against the government. That means we're not in a dictatorship yet. But Fidel Castro's Cuba is a dictatorship. Political prisoners are thrown in jail and mistreated. It also should be said that Fidel Castro has provided for his people in many ways with things like health care and other things that you would see in Michael Moore's movie, and that the people that prior to Fidel Castro, we supported a dictator, Batista. So I'm not saying that Fidel Castro is some Democrat, but I'm also not saying he's worse than the dictator that we supported before. When it comes to United States foreign policy, that's the interesting thing to me, is that we support a whole host of dictators in Cuba, in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia. I believe it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt who once said of Anastasio Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua. I think it was him. It could have been Johnson. Whoever it was, we had a U.S. president that said of Somoza, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard. And this realism idea in U.S. foreign policy led us to support the Shah of Iran, another bastard, another dictator, one who tortured his own people. And indeed, our CIA taught him how to torture his own people. We trained his secret police, the SAVAK. The question is, when should we support dictatorships and when should we not? In Cuba, it's the end of Fidel Castro's reign. But that's just because he's old and his brother Raul Castro will take over and there will be very little change in Cuba. Now, interestingly, most of the rest of the world has ceased punishing this dictatorship, right? Canada, even Canada, our closest ally, will trade with Cuba, will allow people to visit Cuba. The European Union also has trade with Cuba. So our sanctions are pretty useless. George Bush just recently said, in fact, that Cubans can't visit their home. Cubans that have come to the United States of America can't go home and can't bring money back there. But I don't see how this does any good in bringing home the Castro government. Either we have to convince the rest of the world that Castro needs to be deposed, or it's just really not working. I think what we need to do, frankly, is what Senator Obama says to be done, and Senator Clinton, too, to a lesser extent. Let's talk with Castro. You know, Fidel Castro and his brother Raul Castro, they have said all kinds of wonderful ideals. Kind of reminds me of the Soviet Union promising all kinds of human rights in the Helsinki Accords. And although the Soviet Union never came through on those rights, the mere fact that they promised them gave us leverage in order to force the Soviet Union to not be hypocrites, right? I mean, they were being hypocritical, but we could go to the world and say, hey, they promised human rights and they're not doing it. Castro may even be pushed around a little bit further, but pushed around in the right way, pushed around in a smart way. Again, I have no problem going after dictators, but let's make a deal with Castro. This is a deal, by the way, that Senator Obama and Senator Clinton supports. I have seen it specifically, though, from Senator Obama. And the deal is very simple. Have free elections. Have free elections, monitored so that we know that they're free and fair. Allow opposition parties to form and run against Castro. Open up the press. And lo and behold, we will end the embargo, end the diplomatic isolation, trade with Cuba. Just have free elections. I think, though, we have to distinguish between two separate things. One is the question of dictatorship versus democracy. The other is the question of capitalism versus socialism. We do have a right, I think, as a defender of free peoples, to try to encourage democracy around the world. Just because George Bush says that too does not mean the idea is a bad idea. George Bush doesn't know how to do it. But let's not assume it's a bad idea simply because he says it. It is good to spread democracy around the world. But how do you spread democracy around the world? Well, with Cuba, we have two complaints. One is it's not free, and that's a fair complaint. It should be said that we don't make that complaint among our allies, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Egypt and Saudi Arabia are certainly more brutal dictators than Fidel Castro. Egypt has political prisoners, Egypt has torture, and we give Egypt some $1 billion a year and they really don't have any enemies. I'm not sure why we are giving so much weaponry to Egypt. Who's threatening Egypt? I mean, Saudi Arabia arguably is being threatened by Iran, maybe? Maybe? I don't know. I'm not even sure who's threatening Saudi Arabia these days. I guess we just want the money for the arms. But Egypt is just as bad as Castro. We're doing nothing about Egypt, and we should be. We should have one consistent policy, and that is to say to dictators, we'll work with you. We won't embargo you. We won't sanction you. Now, I should say this. If you have a warlike nation, a nation that is threatening other nations, then I think sanctions are appropriate. Or if you have a nation that's doing to its own people horrible things like genocide or apartheid. I did think that sanctions against South Africa were appropriate. I did think that sanctions against Iraq were appropriate. They were supported by the rest of the world. Here you had nations that were harming their own people, not just political prisoners, but people of a different race, or they were causing wars against other countries. I think you have to look. There are differences among dictatorships. But with Castro, the answer, it seems to me, is to ask him to put up or shut up, say that we have no beef with the Cuban people. All we want is democracy. But in saying so, I don't think we have a right to take a position on capitalism versus socialism. That is completely a job for the Cuban people. We have a right, I think, to push worldwide to let peoples of the world vote in their own governments. That's a good thing. We don't have a right to decide their economic systems. One of the main reasons why the United States opposed Castro, let's be clear, is because he expropriated all the land and money of the multinational corporations from America, they controlled so much of Cuba. There was the sugar industry. It was making profit for large American multinationals. And we didn't like that they took that over. Okay. That's from 1959. It's done. It's over. They believe in redistribution. There's no hope in going back. If the people of Cuba want to vote in a government that supports more capitalism and less socialism, that's their choice. All we have a right to do is to support their right to decide. There was such an election against a dictator all the way on the other side of the world in a country that should concern us far more than Cuba. The country, of course, is Pakistan. And the voters of Pakistan delivered a stunning rebuke just yesterday to its president. It's hard to even call him a president since he received that title from a coup d'etat. Let's just say its leader, its dictator, Musharraf. Now, Pakistan obviously calls for concern because Pakistan has nuclear weapons. There are only 3 dictatorships in the entire world. Well, excuse me, 4. There are only 4 dictatorships in the entire world that we know have nuclear weapons: China, Russia, North Korea, and Pakistan. Now, North Korea didn't have nuclear weapons when Bill Clinton was in charge, but that's another question of how you deal with dictators. Bill Clinton understood that sometimes you need carrots as well as sticks, gave some carrots to North Korea, and made sure they didn't develop nuclear weapons. George Bush was concerned about other things. While he wasn't looking and invading Iraq, North Korea, again, a very brutal dictatorship, did obtain nuclear weapons. I don't think we can have much effect on Russia or China. Certainly not on China. I mean, China is a dictatorship. And we don't, they have a lot of nuclear weapons. There's not much we can do there except try to encourage them to do the right thing. Maybe we can use trade policy. Russia, by the way, I should say, when I say 4 dictatorships, I included Russia because Russia was a dictatorship with the Soviet Union, became very close to a democracy under Yeltsin, but is now coming right back to a dictatorship under Putin. It's not quite there yet. Maybe I should say 3.5 countries have dictatorships, have nuclear weapons. But we are slowly letting Russia go back to dictatorship. And again, there are things that we should do, can do, to encourage them to do the right thing. Russia is a very dangerous country. We fought the Cold War for 50 years. They have a very large nuclear weapons cash, And frankly, you know, Americans, we have no beef with any of these peoples. There's no reason why Russia has to go back to dictatorship. That's something that we really need to be concerned about. So we have Russia, we have North Korea, we have China, and we have Pakistan. Now, Pakistan, there is hope for. With the election yesterday, no help, no, not because of George Bush. George Bush was supporting Musharraf to the end, unfortunately. But to the people of Pakistan, many of them upset by the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, we have an opportunity to have change. And it's very exciting what happened in Pakistan yesterday. Very exciting. So I'm going to take a break and give you a chance to call in. The number is 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let's talk about U.S. foreign policy, not just in Iraq. We talk about Iraq a lot, but elsewhere around the world. What should be the United States' role in protecting against dictators? We'll be right back with more of The Inside Scoop right after this.
Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell. This is from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote, and then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found the first sign. A small, discolored hard patch of plastic on my right shoulder. I thought it would go away on its own, but it didn't. It kept spreading. And when I could no longer conceal it with a t-shirt, I knew I had to see the doctor. He said I had this early stage of mannequinism and that my only hope was to get involved, even if it was something simple. So I began reading the newspaper and instantly got feeling back in my arm. I guess you could say I'm living proof you can fight mannequinism.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the story about a group of kids who volunteered.
We fixed stuff. Did some art projects with the kids.
Cleaned up the park.
We worked in the woods.
I just wanted to do something.
We fixed up this house.
Did something for the planet.
Hey, that was all I needed.
And you know what? It was great.
It was a blast.
At first, they didn't know each other.
I didn't know anyone.
Well, that didn't last long.
This guy is really funny.
Me?
These are my new friends. These are really good new friends.
Are you into it?
Are You Into It is a volunteer program for kids like you who care. If you want to make a difference in your community and make friends, call 4-H toll-free at 1-888-77-YOUTH or check out our website at www.areyouintoit.com.
This definitely made a difference.
I feel like I can do everything now.
Yeah.
A public service message brought to you by 4-H, the Cooperative Extension System, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. We are returning. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy under George Bush. When we left, I was discussing the situation in Pakistan. Now, Pakistan is an interesting case because it's one of those countries that could become a democracy or could be a dictatorship. In many ways, it's like Russia, where it's a country that's on the verge of going one way or the other, and it's why it's so important for us to push it one way or the other, and that's something that we can do. I was very impressed with the large response of the Pakistanis, voting a clear majority to get Musharraf out of office. In fact, both opposition parties received twice the amount of votes that his party did. It was an astounding victory. The question will be, though, what will Musharraf do? Will he leave into that good night? Will he respect the will of the Pakistani people, or won't he? Here's where we need the kind of diplomacy that a leader like Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, I think, could do. I'm afraid, though, that President Bush won't go far enough. Dave from California, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark. I wanted to talk a little bit more about Fidel Castro because I think maybe most others have been lied to for almost 50 years now. We see the face of Fidel Castro on our TV screen. We never hear him, and we hear a moderator talking about the hated dictator of Cuba. I live in a country where the greedy rich are trying to take as much as they possibly can from the working people and the poor. About a year or two ago, I got to hear Fidel Castro speaking on Free Speech TV, and I learned quite a different story than what I've been told. He spoke of all of the people in Cuba having a house to live in, food, and health care. He talked of a country, as poor as they are, that's providing most of the positions to the rest of the poor countries of the world. He said in that same speech, if I learned ever that my soldiers were torturing prisoners, I would, on that very day, resign my presidency. But, this may not be the hated dictator. He walks around with his people, no guards. He wears a private uniform, no limousine, no gold thrones and whatnot. I don't think we got a hated dictator here.
Well, you know, he talks a good game. I'll grant you that. And I'll also grant you that he, in some ways, has done quite well in Cuba. Now, their economy is pretty lousy, but I would dare say that the poorest of their poor are probably better off than the poorest of our poor. So, in other words, everyone is fairly poor, but no one is suffering as badly as our poor. I mean, in other words, in terms of a socialist ideal, in terms of redistributing wealth from the rich to the poor, in terms of making sure everyone has health care, he does a decent job. I'll grant you that. Now, it should be noted that Castro carefully controls the press. He doesn't allow opposition parties to form. He does jail political opponents. He does indeed have, I don't know whether he tortures people in his prisons or not. There are rumors of such. But the point is that he doesn't allow an opposition candidate to form. I agree with you. That's why I said that we should have in no way seek to influence Cuba's choice of whether to be a capitalist or socialist country. That is their choice. I do think, though, that we have a right to encourage Cuba to become a democracy, which is why I support lifting the embargo. I support ending the sanctions, but I would do so contingent on them having a free election. And I think that's a fair choice. I mean, Castro is not the best thing since sliced bread. I'm not going to go around and praise him. I do agree he's less dangerous than many other dictators around the globe. But I'm not going to, praise him either.
Well, I've come to regard him as a far, far better form of government than what we're suffering from right now in this country. That he is, at heart, looking out for his people and not trying to grab everything he can for the corporate rich.
He is trying to grab, 60% of Cuba's economy is run by the government. Now, if you have a country that truly can fairly elect its leaders, then if you want 60% of the country to be run by the government, again, that's the people's choice. That's fine. I'm not knocking socialism. Democratic socialism is fine with me. It's not a choice I would make for my country, but people have the right to make that choice. But when his country controls 60% of the entire economy, I don't think we can simply say that Fidel Castro is just about looking out for his people. You're right that he does take care of the poor better than we do, no question about it. But he is still a dictator, and I don't want to make light of that. I think sometimes people want to make things black or white, and they say that, well, because Bush is opposed to Castro or Castro is opposed to Bush, that he's a wonderful person. I don't think he is a wonderful person. I do think that if he could leave a lasting legacy to his people by granting them free elections, then I think then that would be a terrific thing for Cuba. And I don't even think that's out of the question. I think with the right president, maybe we need a President Obama in there, I think we can persuade Raul Castro, who's also getting on in age, to perhaps transition their country to democracy. I think the right measure of carrots and sticks can work. But I don't want to give full praise to Fidel Castro either, because if he were a true leader, he truly wanted to do what the Cuban people want, he would give them a choice in their elections.
Well, I see him walking about with his people, no guards. And at least I never saw any. And if somebody... If he really were a hated dictator, any one of the thousands of people walking around with him would have but to reach down and grab a rock and bash him over the head.
Here's the thing. I think he's a dictator. I didn't say he was a hated dictator. In some ways, he may be a benevolent dictator. There's no question that there are poor people in Cuba that very much like Fidel Castro. So I didn't even say he was hated. I do think he's a dictator, though. And again, if Fidel Castro has done terrific by Cuba, and if they have a free election and the people vote him in or vote Raul Castro in, I'm fine with that. I am perfectly fine with that. But I do think at the end of the day the Cuban people need to decide. Now, again, I wouldn't take the policy that George Bush has done, the last nine presidents have done. But at the same time, I guess I'm a moderate. I don't want to praise everything Fidel Castro has done either. If he will stand for a fair election. Look, I want our leaders to stand for a fair election. One of my biggest complaints, of course, is that George Bush came into office not on a fair election, but on a coup d'etat from the United States Supreme Court. So I think I'm at least being consistent in calling for democracy everywhere around the globe, including in my own country. Last comment, Dave?
We could use a little democracy here, I think, yes.
We certainly can. Thank you for your call. I do appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Let me move on to the question of Pakistan, because Pakistan is in a magical moment right now. It is tragic that the murder of Benazir Bhutto had to happen. I don't know that it had to happen, but it's tragic that it did happen. But it may be that that murder leads to a good cause. Her party did the best, winning 88 seats. The opposition party, the one that Musharraf overturned in 1999, won 66 votes. His party, Musharraf, received only 39. We need now to gently push him out of office. The Pakistani people are on our side. Look, they want him gone. And the United States can stand on their side or can stand on Musharraf's side. And you got to understand, he's going to lose. At some point, he'll be pushed out. It's not just a question of the fact that, you know, democracy is a good thing and I want to see Musharraf go for that reason. But because the Pakistani people want it, if we are on the wrong side of history, then when a new Pakistani becomes leader and has all those nuclear weapons and has Al-Qaeda sitting in Pakistani hinterlands, then they won't help us. See, it's not just a question of I support democracy because democracy is right and good. I support democracy because it also leads to alliances with the United States. With Cuba and with Pakistan, think about where we are if we simply say we support the people's choice. Free elections in Cuba. If they vote for Castro, fine. If they don't, fine. We had free elections in Pakistan. We were afraid that Musharraf wouldn't have free elections, but he did, maybe believing, like some many dictators stupidly believe, that he was going to win. Noriega made that mistake, and Daniel Ortega also made that mistake. But he lost. And it's time for him to leave, and we need to gently but firmly show him the door. Elsewhere in the world, we had the new nation of Kosovo declare its independence from Serbia. I have a lot of sympathy for the nation of Kosovo. Kosovo is or was a province of Serbia that was more than 75% of Albanian Muslim heritage. Today it's 90% of Albanian Muslim heritage and about 10% of Serbian Orthodox heritage. And like all the other provinces of Yugoslavia, when its dictator Tito died, it all fell apart. The Croatians, who are Catholic, were separate from the Slovenians, who I believe are Protestant, were separate from the people of Macedonia, who are Greek Orthodox and Serbian Orthodox and Montenegro and Albania, Kosovo. Each of the own peoples wanted control over their own identity. And some people don't understand nationalism. Some people don't understand why it is that we can't all live together. But I get it. When you've lived in a land where you've been oppressed, when you live in a land where people of a certain nationality are oppressed only because they're of that nationality, you want one country, at least on earth, where you know you'll be safe, where you know you won't be oppressed merely because of your religion or your language or the color of your skin. The people of Kosovo were brutally treated by the Serbian government. Some people want to gloss over that fact. I don't. I don't gloss over it at all. Now, the way that the Kosovars fought back wasn't all pretty either. That's certainly true. But the main thing is that the people of Kosovo should have the right. They're 90% of the territory. As long as they don't declare war on Serbia, right? As long as they're not attacking other countries, they should have a right to a state of their own. Now, I think that the 10% or so of Kosovo that is Serbian populated should be allowed to stay with Serbia for the same reason, just as I think that Kosovo should be allowed to be independent. You can actually see the borders. So I think that part of Kosovo that is Albanian or should be allowed to be independent should be allowed to join with Albania if it wants. But I also think that the part of Kosovo that is Serbian should be allowed to stay with Serbia. Good fences make good neighbors, my friends. And sometimes you have to separate peoples who have been warring each other with each other in order to have a calming down period so they can then come together. In many ways, that's exactly what happened with the European Union, right? France and Germany and England fought many, many wars before they could finally come in peace and join together at a European Union. We have to allow the same thing to happen with Kosovo. I fully support Kosovo independence, though I also support the right of the Serbian enclaves, particularly the one in the north that borders Serbia, to remain in Serbia. That's self-determination as far as I'm concerned, and as long as they're not trying to kill each other, that makes sense to me. Juanita, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi, this is Juanita.
I know. what do you want to talk about?
I say what I wanted to say about Cuba.
Yeah.
I want you to know that I've worked around people from Cuba, you know, exiles and so forth, and probably in Florida you work around and meet all kind of people.
Right,
you know?
Right. So most are very against the Castro government. Right.
What I'm concerned about is you hear a lot of the famous people over here and some of the Congress people that are exiles from Cuba or their parents were born there talking about that they will go back only after Castro dies. And I'm wondering, are they going to go and try to reclaim the land that they had before and take away from the people that and change their way of life and all? Or are they going to do
that? Well, I think they are. And I think that's a real problem. That's why I really want to distinguish. I want to make a huge distinguishing thing between right to democracy, which I believe every people has, and the right for the rich of Cuba to get back their expropriated lands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like if the people of Cuba that lost their lands because they were of, I don't know, a certain ethnic class or something like, or, you know, maybe they were a certain race or a certain religion, then I would say, well, you know, that's racist, that's a problem. But the reason why their lands were expropriated, my understanding was, because they had most of the land of Cuba in the control of a few, very few rich landowners,
right.
And Castro believed in redistribution of wealth.
Right.
That rule, it seems to me, It's something for the Cuban people to decide. I'm not saying that the United States government should be opposed to them coming back and trying to grab it either. I'm just saying we shouldn't take a position one way or the other on that.
That's the mindset of a lot of them.
Well, I think it is, and to me that's an internal Cuban question. The one thing I think we should support is democracy in Cuba. But whether or not they get those lands back, I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
I know, but, you know, I think that's their mindset is that they...
I agree with you.
They've done a lot of great things, you know, the way they take care of the older people and the way they take care of the mentally ill and all that wasn't done before. I mean, it was horrible when the...
No, you're right. You're right. And that's why I just want to be clear. Look, I understand why the people who want their lands back are angry. I get that. I understand why when you have a very small landowning class, you might want to redistribute the wealth among the people. I would hope, and this is where I think the United States could actually be a good faith mediator, that you could come to some form of compromise, maybe some kind of reimbursement less than the value that it's worth, but more than zero. I think that there actually a compromise can be had, but as far as I'm concerned, a country does have a right to redistribute from the wealth to the poor. I'm not saying that I necessarily support it, but I'm saying that they have the right to do that if that's what the people vote for.
They're better off. The poor there are better off.
The poor are better off. Now, the rich are worse off. I mean, let's face it. The rich in Cuba are worse off, and frankly, their economy is not real strong. But I do think that there. I mean, I think, for example, in the rest of the Caribbean, you would find stronger economies.
I think it may do with what they had, you know.
Well, yes, they have.
Believe me, I have friends who are very anti-Castro. Believe me.
It's hard for me because I try to make my own positions on these things, not based on what the Democratic or Republican Party says, not based on what Castro says, not based on what the exiles. I try to look at the entire issue and try to come down to what I think is right. And I take a view that you rarely hear because it's a middle position. I'm not saying the exiles are right or Castro is right. I do think Castro has to allow democracy, and in that point,
he is a dictator.
Right. I think the exiles are right about that. But I don't think they're necessarily right about the expropriated lands. And so that's something that's just going to have to be worked out among Cubans. But I'll tell you this.
Pardon?
Yeah, before you go to your next subject, let me just say this. I do think that if we were to get a democracy in Cuba, and I don't think that's out of the question, I think the newly elected government might be able, with the right kind of U.S. government, again, think President Obama, work out a deal with the Cuban exiles in Miami, where the Cuban exiles won't get everything they want, certainly, but will get something and hopefully can end some of this animosity. Go ahead, Juanita.
You remember when they had the little boy there?
Elian Gonzalez.
Yeah. I watched all that on all that news show, and they were very arrogant down there about that and that little boy.
Yes, they were.
And I have a friend who's from Jamaica, and it took her a long time to get to be a citizen, and she was married to an American. And she didn't know. She kept wondering, well, why are they keeping that child here? She didn't understand it. And I told her about, you know, if a Cuban came and stepped foot in the United States, they could stay here if they wanted to.
Right.
And she said, well, why did they do that? And I said, it's been going on since 1960. And
I'm not sure it's that old.
Why they still do that.
You know, Juanita, I don't know. So I don't want to claim I know when I don't know. But I thought it was Ronald Reagan that instituted that policy in the 80s. But I could be wrong. I don't ever want to state anything.
For a long time.
All right. If you say so.
Maybe not exactly that way, but they had a lot of benefits that the other immigrants did not have.
But that's been true. We have the weirdest immigration policy in the world. I mean, people don't even realize that, for example, Irish nationals have they get to jump ahead of the line to everybody else, and that's largely because the Kennedys put that in because they're Irish Americans. And, you know, I like Ireland as much as any country. I think it's a terrific people, a wonderful tradition. You know, I love Irish Americans, but I don't know that they should have
that's been going on for a long time.
A cut in the line.
Not necessarily Irish, but white people having the...
Well, it depends where. It just depends where. Yeah. We have a very mixed-up immigration system. Irish, and Cubans get priorities because they have political groups that help them. Look, as far as I'm concerned, a rational immigration policy would definitely look at, you know, people who can help the country, people who, you know, intelligent scientists and teachers and so forth that can really add to the U.S. from wherever they are in the world. But when it comes to persecuted people, I also think the United States needs to be a haven for people who are fleeing persecution.
Yeah,
to give the clearest example, if we ever were to get a refugee from Darfur, God knows how they'd get here. But we should certainly take them in because they are suffering. I mean, even Bush has admitted it's genocide right now. So if we didn't take them in...
Our problem is that we don't want to learn from anybody else, and I think we could learn a lot from what they've done down there in Cuba with medically.
We can.
Especially.
The problem is that whenever you're learning from a dictator, you have to wonder. I mean, I'm not condemning any of the socialist acts of Fidel Castro, but, you know... It's hard when you – I mean, I have to tell you, and you may feel differently from I do, Juanita, but I loved Michael Moore's movie Sicko. I thought it was a terrific movie.
You love what?
And I liked his movie Sicko. I thought it was a very powerful movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Juanita, how can you not see that movie?
I haven't had a chance.
Well, go see it. Go rent it. It's one of the most important movies of our time. But in that movie, you see Michael Moore talk about the English system – talk about the French system,
right.
Talk about the Canadian system, and he talks about the Cuban system.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that when I talk about Sicko, and I talk about health care in America, I mention France, I mention England, I mention Canada, I don't mention Cuba. And it's not because I think that their health care system is wrong, but because to me there's a difference between Canadians, French, and English people freely electing their leaders who choose national health care, which I think is terrific. I'd like to see it happen here. And Castro, who took over power and sort of imposed it. Now, I have no doubt that Cubans would continue their national health care system if they had a democracy. But I'm always a little reluctant to praise Castro too much just because I'd rather learn from Canada or Britain or France. I feel more comfortable learning from countries that are democracies than countries that are dictatorships. You understand? I'm sort of two minds with Cuba.
Well, I'm a Christian, but I believe in giving the devil his due. You know,
fair enough.
If you get what I mean, but
thank you. Go
it's
ahead.
It's a long detailed situation. You know, I do believe we could learn a lot just from the little things that they do down there that are different. You know,
well, and I hope that we can persuade Cuba to become a democracy, and then if they want to continue all they're doing with social policy and economics. You know, God bless them. That's fine with me. Thanks for your call, Juanita. I appreciate
it. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Other nations on Earth. Of course, George Bush is visiting Africa and doing little to nothing to stop the continuing genocide in Darfur. He's not even visiting anywhere near Darfur. He's going to Rwanda to talk about the genocide of a decade ago under Bill Clinton rather than going to where genocide is happening now. And where he admits that genocide is happening now. Now, I rarely believe in U.S. unilateral action. I usually prefer that we get international support. And frankly, when we're right, we should be able to get international support. In Kosovo, for example, in the 1990s, when there was ethnic cleansing going on down there, when there were safe havens for the Albanian Muslims, and the U.N. set them up and they were still killed in Srebrenica and elsewhere, where the Serbians tried to run out 90% of the population, we had a war under Bill Clinton that I supported, that I thought was just. And so did the rest of the world. The rest of the world had done nothing for years and years and years. And finally, when Bill Clinton acted, even in support of Muslims, now they were white and they were European, granted, but they were Muslims, and we helped them survive genocide. And I think that the nation of Kosovo, I know that the new independent nation of Kosovo will love America from now till any time forward. They will be our ally for life. And I also think many Serbians understand, as much as they hated what we did then, that, you know, they had a dictator at the time, Milosevic, and they've gotten rid of him. And I think many of them understand that we did the right thing there too. So when we do the right thing, I think rewards are paid. Anyway, George Bush is in Africa, not visiting because, hey, he's got to check that off before he leaves his presidency, right? He's only got 11 months to go. And he, well, that's a good thing. And he wants to just make sure that, hey, he's gone to Africa. But does he do anything about dictatorships in Africa? No. Even the great AIDS funding proposal that he had has barely been funded. And frankly, in Africa, they have more severe crises than AIDS, things like malaria. I know that George Bush in Africa will be a huge wash. Nothing will happen. I do want to go to one other place in the world, one that I think I get more criticism in this program than any other place. But we have to talk about Gaza. We have to talk about the misery of the Palestinians living in Gaza, living under the Hamas dictatorship. Now, Hamas was elected by the Palestinians a few years back when the Palestinians thought that they would be less corrupt than Fatah. It was truly not a great choice. You had the very corrupt Fatah, and then you had the warlike Hamas. Hamas is now sending 40 missiles a day, 40 missiles a day across the border into Israel, trying to kill as many people as possible. Israel has responded by shutting off the aid it used to give Gaza, and it's still actually giving some humanitarian aid. I frankly think that should stop. And the missiles are starting to dwindle. And the people in Gaza are starting to wonder why they have a government that instead of feeding the people of Gaza, caring for the people of Gaza, building up Gaza, is still devoted simply to killing people. And what I find shocking is that we hear so little about this. There's about to be another war, my friends, and it's going to occur between Israel and Gaza, and there's a reason for that, because Gaza is shooting 40 missiles a day into Israel. You know, I remember back when Israel occupied Gaza, and people said, hey, Israel should leave, and if they leave, Gaza will be peaceful. If they would just leave the Palestinians alone, build a wall, good fences make good neighbors, which I think is generally true, and leave them alone, let them go to Egypt, let them provide on their own. Israel left them, and the government has not gave a damn about its own people, has spent its entire resources lobbing missiles into Israel, killing as many people as possible. The Palestinians in Gaza are suffering, and they're suffering entirely due to their own government. I read an article recently in the New York Times about a family in Gaza where they desperately tried to get Hamas to get out of their orchards. Hamas would occupy the trees on this border territory with Israel and then shoot missiles into Israel. Israel would respond, and then the people in Gaza would run and hide, and this would just continue time after time, and they killed lots of Israelis that way. Until finally, Israel shot back and not only killed the Gaza terrorists of Hamas, but also killed a 56-year-old woman who, at least according to the story, was out there trying to get the terrorists to leave her property. Finally, her son did the right thing, perhaps the only thing to do. He chopped down all his trees, because he knew that only then would Hamas stop coming into his neighborhood, stop shooting missiles into Israel. Only then would he be safe. The people of Gaza need an election. They need an election badly. And I am firmly convinced that if the people of Gaza get a chance to vote, they will not vote for Hamas. Hamas has done nothing good for Gaza. They are poorer and more miserable than ever before. I support an independent Palestinian state, just like I support a state in Kosovo and Cuba and Pakistan, but I support one that isn't making war against its neighbors, one that recognizes the international boundary. Israel doesn't occupy a single inch of Gaza, and there wouldn't have to be checkpoints, and there wouldn't have to be blockages of aid if only Gaza would stop trying to destroy Israel. And I don't think most people in Gaza want that to happen. I really don't. Now, recently, you may recall, the Gazans were so upset by their situation that they crashed through another border wall, the wall with Egypt. And I don't know if you know the history of Egypt and Gaza. Prior to 1948. Prior, this was all, Gaza was part of Palestine, all of which was supposed to be a Jewish homeland, while Transjordan, which became Jordan, was supposed to be the Arab homeland. But in 1947, the United Nations divided Western Palestine into two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. The Jewish state eventually became Israel. The Arab state, however, was occupied by Jordan and Egypt. The reason Gaza exists is because Egypt occupied land in 1947 and 48 that was supposed to be the new Palestinian state. Egypt ruled over Gaza from 1947 until 1967, 20 years. And the refugee camps in Gaza today were built by Egyptian authorities. They built the camps. They didn't allow the citizens of Gaza to form their own Palestinian state. They also didn't allow them to become citizens of Egypt. Look at maps prior to 1967. You will see that Gaza was part of Egypt. Now, Israel would have no problem with Gaza being part of Egypt. I dare say Israelis would dance in the street if that were the case. Is that good for the people of Gaza? Well, it ain't great. Hamas is a horrible dictatorship. Mubarak, the head of Egypt, is a horrible dictator. I would say this, though. I think the horrible dictator of Egypt is less horrible than the horrible dictators of Hamas. Because at least Egypt is not busy shooting missiles into Israel and getting reprisals onto its territory. Is Egypt, dictator though it is, does have a peace treaty with Israel. Egypt doesn't allow political opponents. It's just as bad as Cuba or Saudi Arabia or Musharraf. Actually, Musharraf may be doing better. But if Egypt were to occupy Gaza, that would be fine. I think it would actually give a better life for the Palestinians there. Not much better, but better, because at least the war would end and they could, you know, there'd be no more missiles back and forth, right? If Egypt were to occupy Gaza, then they could at least start rebuilding their streets and building sewers and building schools. Yes, they would live under Mubarak, and no, that's not pleasant. But I do think that's an option. The other option, of course, is to have the people of Gaza themselves elect in a government that doesn't believe in shooting missiles into Israel. I mean, imagine 40 missiles a day. We know how our country reacted to one day, September 11th, and four attacks that day. Imagine if we had 40 missiles a day raining on one American city. And today wrote Israel, you have your children who every single day hear 40 booms. That's not good for any city. Israel has to respond, but they respond, and that's not good for the people of Gaza. It's time for the entire world to come down hard on Hamas. And if you're wondering why the United Nations hasn't condemned Hamas and its unprovoked military attacks into Israel, then you've learned something about the United Nations. Because the United Nations never cares when Gaza attacks. They only care when Israel responds. I expect Israel to respond over the next few weeks and to respond quite harshly to finally stop these missile attacks. At that point, I expect